at emotional health this evening. From the Buddhist viewpoint, we are emotionally sick. Might as well be blunt, you know, start everything off being blunt. In the sense that our minds are overwhelmed by what we call three poisonous attitudes: ignorance, clinging attachment, and animosity. And so as long as those three rule our mind, we don't have the perfect emotional health. It's very hard to have perfect emotional health. It's going to take a while to get there, but I think as much as we can practice the path and get going in that way, it'll definitely be beneficial. I was thinking, what's the name of the book, the DRC, the one that all the therapists have? What's
DSM.
DSM. Okay. So there's how many different categories in there? More, a lot, and they're coming up with more each year, right? Okay. The Buddha started out with 84,000 and left it at that. Okay. So, but those 84,000 can be condensed into three. So, you know, it makes it easier just to think of three. And actually, those three are, if you want to condense them into further, we can get down to two. Okay. So these two are the big troublemakers. And one is called self-grasping ignorance. And the other one is called self-centered thought. So these two are kind of like the, dare I say it, the George Bush and Dick Cheney of our emotional illness. And if you've ever wanted to impeach the president, what we want to impeach is our own self-centered attitude and self-grasping ignorance, okay? Because these are the two ones that really cause all the warfare, all the internal turmoil, and all the discord that we have with other sentient beings. So the self-grasping ignorance is a mind that misconceives how things exist, and it projects or imputes a way of existence onto people and onto phenomena that they don't have. Okay, and it makes everything seem very solid, as if it had its own essence, its own meanness. Okay, so in the sense of our own self, which is one of the big factors of the self-grasping, there's this sense of a big I. Yeah? Do you have that? Yeah? When you wake up in the morning, who do you think about? Yeah. Who do you think about all day? Yeah. When we don't get what we want, what's the feeling of I? Yeah? Is it a small kind of cooperative I, or is it a big, heavy duty, screaming, yelling, throwing temper tantrum, don't ignore me kind of I? It's a pretty solid big one, isn't it? Okay? So this sense of I that we have that really operates so many aspects of our life is something that we need to bring into question and to see if the I of the person, if it really exists in the way it appears to. Okay, so that's a whole topic. You know, do we exist in the way that we appear to? I won't get into that so much right now. But the other one, the vice president, okay, the self-centered attitude, is the mind that says, okay, there's this big, strong, solid, inherent, independently existent me, and it just happens to be the center of the world. Okay? And that's kind of the way we live our life, right? Don't we kind of live our life as if we're the center of the universe? I mean, that's when we wake up in the morning, we think about ourselves all day long. We think about ourselves. At night, we dream about ourselves. everything is based on me, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we assess and evaluate everything in relationship to me. We think that we're perceiving things objectively.
Yeah.
We have this feeling like there's this external objective world and external people out there, and that we're just kind of coming along and perceiving them as they are from their side. But in actual fact, that's not the way it is. We're filtering everything, okay? And we're especially filtering everything through this perspective of me, I, my, and mine, okay? So how everything relates to the center of the universe, me. And one of the big problems we have is that the rest of the universe doesn't realize that we're the center of it. You know? And so, you know, we really should get everything we want, don't you think? Yeah, don't you think we're entitled to get everything we want? Our basic slogan is, I want what I want when I want it. You know, and we feel as if we're completely entitled to that, and the universe owes it to us because we're so wonderful, and the universe should be very happy to have us in it, especially as its center. And we go through life expecting everything to go according to our conceptions and our preconceptions. So whatever our plans are, we think that's the way things should happen. Whatever our ideas are, that's the best idea, the way everybody should think. Okay? Whatever we want is exactly what we should get. Whatever we don't want should be eliminated immediately. Okay? And we go through life expecting this. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, like I said, that the rest of the universe just doesn't realize we're the center of it. And so we don't always get what we want when we want it. And sometimes we get what we don't want when we don't want it. Yeah. And then that makes us very upset. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so then the anger comes, doesn't it? Yeah. So the attachment is this mind, you know, I want what I want when I want it. And when we get certain things, you know, that make us feel good, we get attached to them. And then when we don't get what we want, or when we get what we want and it's not as good as it was supposed to be, you know that one? Or we get what we want and then we separate from it without our choice, then again, you know, we get very hostile and angry and upset inside. Okay? And so we focus everything just on I as we go through the day, you know, and then wonder why we have so many problems. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we all wonder, why do I have so many problems? I'm just a sweet little innocent person, full of goodwill, walking down the road. And then all these nasty, horrible things happen to me that I don't deserve. And then we throw a pity party. Okay? We do two things when we don't get what we want. One is we throw a pity party, and the other one is we get mad. Okay? How many of you are pity partiers? Oh, come on, there's more than seven of us. How many are pity partiers? Okay. How many of us get angry? How many do both? Okay. So we can really get into it. You know, any problem we have, then, you know, our problem, because remember, we're the center of the universe, then our problem becomes the most serious problem in the entire universe happening that day. I mean, forget the war in Iraq. Yeah. Forget racial and gender discrimination. Forget what's happening in Darfur. You know, my colleague didn't say hello this morning. That is the most serious thing. Okay. Or, you know, my husband forgot to buy the peanut butter. And he always forgets to buy the peanut butter. And he knows I like peanut butter. And I think there's something passive-aggressive going on in this marriage. You know, all related to this peanut butter. You know, so, right? So, you know, we get quite involved in whatever our own story is. You know, we when we were in English class, we probably felt bereft of ideas when it came to a creative writing assignment. But actually, if we look in our lives, we are creative writing all the time. Yeah, and we're very excellent creative writers. We write melodramas. Okay? And who's the star of our melodrama? Just coincidentally, myself, you know? But all day long, we are writing melodramas based on the main character, me. When I was a little kid, my parents used to call me Sarah Bernhardt. It took me the longest time to figure out who Sarah Bernhardt was. For those of you who don't know, she was a film star, I think of the silent movies, was it? But very dramatic. So even though I didn't feel like I was very dramatic, I guess I came off that way to the people around me. I mean, I just felt like I was being honest. Yeah. And it took me years to actually realize that, yes, I, you know, do tend to be a little bit dramatic. But it's all this self-centered mind that makes the big drama out of our own life and what's happening to us. And we will take any small incident. You know, it doesn't have to be a big one at all. Something very small, like the peanut butter. You know? And we will write a whole melodrama based on the peanut butter. Huh? Yeah? Those of you who've been married have probably witnessed similar things, have you? You know? Just small little things. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, peanut butter, and dear, I asked you to buy the peanut butter, why didn't you? You know, you're always forgetting the things that I ask you to do. And this has been going on for the last 15 years since we've been married. And every time I talk to you about it, you have some excuse. And I'm getting really fed up because I think there's some, like I said before, passive-aggressive thing going on here. And, you know, I'm not going to let myself be a victim of your passive-aggressive stuff that's permeating this relationship. And I'm totally fed up and want a divorce. You know, and it all began with the peanut butter. But this is what my mind of creative writing does. Okay? And as ammunition, when we're doing our creative writing story, especially in relationships we have with people over time, you know all the little things that happen? Yeah? That you don't comment on at the time, but you put it in your file called ammunition for the next time we have a fight? Yeah? And that file never gets deleted. Yeah? It only gets added to. And you can always find it. It's not one of those files that, you know, you go, oh, what did I call it? You know, you have to do the search function and have your little puppy dog on the computer to find it. No, our ammunition to use for the next fight is, you know, it's on our desktop with a big red button saying, push me. And we do, you know. And we just stockpile everything. All of our little grudges, all the little things that we don't like. And then when we have one major incident, we have it, don't we? Let's pull out that file, and it's not just the peanut butter, but it's also the jelly, you know? And it's the bread, and it's the way you walk, and it's the way you say good morning, and it's, you know, the way you take out the trash, and everything. And so this is all coming about, this whole big melodrama we make in our life, you know, is coming about because of the self-grasping ignorance, thinking that there's a big solid me, and then the self-centered thought that thinks that me is the center of the universe. Okay? Now, the self-centered thought, it works in very interesting ways, okay? Because in one way, it makes us kind of arrogant and seem like, or try and give the feeling like we're better and more important than we are, and, you know, we want more attention to ourselves. And so it's the self-centered I that, you know, makes us always look good in front of other people. You know how when you meet new people? Yeah, we always have a very sweet, loving personality when we meet new people, don't we? Yeah, we're so nice. Oh, please, let me help you. Let me do something for you. We're so nice. Yeah. Then after the relationship's born, then our character comes out. Okay. But we always, you know, put on this very nice show at the beginning and, you know, tell other people about ourselves and how wonderful we are and how talented we are and all the things we've done in our life, every place we've traveled and all the careers that we've had, all of our successes that we've had. You know, we really schmaltz up our life a lot. You know, build it up and make ourselves look really good in front of other people, don't we? Yeah. It's like when you go for a job interview. Yeah, who tells the truth on a job application? You know, we always make it sound like we can do everything on a job application. Now, of course, after they hire us, they find out that we can't do most of the things we said. But we always make ourselves look very, very good. So the self-centered thought, on one hand, inflates the I to make it look better than it is. But our self-centered thought also inflates the I to make it look worse than it is. Because the self-centered one, wants to be the most important one. And if we can't be the best, well, then we'll just settle for being the worst. But we've got to be more than anybody else. Okay? And so the self-centered one on the worst side, this comes about when we're in our pity party time. Okay? And we play the music for our pity party. I'm so awful. Nobody loves me. I do everything wrong. You know? And we get really into being very down on ourselves. Okay? And I mean really into being very down on ourselves. And this is a huge problem in our culture. You know, this low self-esteem, self-criticism, guilt. Okay? Anybody here suffer from that? Oh. Just, come on. Yeah, we all do. Yeah, so it's in there. And we get really wound up with, you know, how terrible we are and nobody loves us and everything we do is wrong and we made everything go wrong in our lives and no wonder we're having this pity party because we're to blame for everything. And we get completely into it. Okay, it's called depression. And we're very good at it, you know. But who's the star of the show? Yeah, when we're feeling guilty and low self-esteem and depressed, who's the star? Who's the central figure? It's me, isn't it? Yeah, it's always me. If I'm not going to be the best, I'm going to be the worst. But, you know, somehow I am special. I am worser than everybody else. Okay. So it's a big difficulty we have. It's very unrealistic, isn't it? You know? Because when we're in our low self-esteem, feeling guilt phase, we have this sense that we're so important that we can make everything go wrong. Well, yeah, you had a fight with somebody that you care about, and you go, it's all my fault. You know, well, first it's all their fault, but then after you get tired of being, you know, angry at them, then it's like, oh, it's all my fault. And that's really not very balanced, is it? You know, it's saying I'm so important I can make everything go wrong. that true? Are we that important that we can make everything go wrong? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So whenever there's something happening between people, there's always, you know, various causes and conditions going on. Yeah, we shouldn't just put it all on ourselves, nor should we put it all on the other person. But this, somehow we want to be special in every aspect of our life, just this wish to be special, to appear somehow. And so, you know, doing our creative writing stories. And since it's easier to do the creative writing about things that don't go the way we want, then we do a lot of that. I think, you know, in thinking about it, in previous generations, I don't think our ancestors had so much time to feel sorry for themselves. Yeah, because they were just trying to stay alive. Yeah, they were trying to, you know, get some food and get some clothing and build a house and stay healthy, and just they were just trying to stay alive. But now we take a lot of that for granted, and so we have the leisure time to be more self-centered and to feel more self-pity. And then we wonder why we're so unhappy. And then you find people saying things like, well, I'm very self-critical and have low self-esteem, and so I have to change my attitude about myself and be kinder to myself. So I'm going to be kind to myself and go out and buy myself a present. Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard people say that. You know, you hear people who have taken care of families. I was giving one talk once, and one woman came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I was taking care of my family for 20 years, sacrificing myself for my family, and I'm totally fed up, and now I'm going to take care of myself, and I'm going to go out and have a good time. And that's the way she said it. You know? And I couldn't actually share with her my perspective at that moment. But, you know, when we talk like that, have we really been sacrificing ourselves for somebody else? Or have we been doing something that looks kind with the expectation of getting something in return? And then is the way to be kind to ourselves to go out and buy something at the store that we don't need, that consumes more of the world's resources than we have, and that puts us in greater credit card debt? Is that being kind to yourself? Yeah, filling your closets with more stuff? I don't think so. You know, I think we're very confused as to what it means to be kind to ourselves. And we're very confused about what it means to not be self-centered. Because when we sometimes begin to see the faults of the self-centeredness, then we think, okay, well, the way to not be self-centered is to never think about myself, not take care of myself at all, and completely take care of everybody else. Okay, so then we become Miss Fix-It or Mr. Fix-It, and we're meddling in everybody else's business, trying to fix them. Okay, because now we're being kind and magnanimous and not self-centered, so we're going to fix everybody else's problems, which means that they should do things our way, because we know it's best for them. Right? Yeah? And then we feel that we're only totally really giving to people if we're suffering. I'm not quite sure where we got that idea. You might have some. Okay? But somehow we feel like we're not being entirely compassionate unless we're miserable in the process of it. Okay? And so that's the way we get into this very strange, peculiar way of taking care of others, which is actually meddling in their affairs and trying to, you know, push our agenda on them. Okay. What Buddhism says about this is that, you know, what we're trying to do is have love and compassion for all sentient beings. So all sentient beings includes us. It doesn't mean everybody minus one. And so sometimes for us in Buddhist practice, this is difficult, you know, because we grew up in this background where we think, you know, if we pay any attention to ourselves, that it's self-centeredness and bad, and to be compassionate, we have to suffer. But no, that's not what the Buddha says, you know. We're taking care of all sentient beings, so it includes ourselves. But we have to know how to take care of ourselves in a wise way. Okay? The way we've been taking care of ourselves until now hasn't actually been the wise way. It's been the self-centered way. But it hasn't been wise because it's actually brought us a whole lot of problems. Okay? Because the more self-centered we are, the more sensitive we become to every small thing in our environment. And so the more bent out of shape we get when, you know, such small things happen. So that kind of self-attention is not very helpful at all. That's not taking care of ourselves. Okay? Taking care of ourselves means wanting ourselves to be happy. Okay. Now, this is the tricky question. What does happiness mean? Our usual way of thinking is happiness means I get what I want when I want it. Okay? But we've already been through that, and we've realized that, you know, having that attitude just makes us more unhappy. Yeah, because we very seldom get what we want when we want it, and even if we do, it isn't as good as it was supposed to be. Okay? So then we have to examine in another way, what really does it mean to be happy? And I think this is something we need to spend some time on, because we've had a lot of societal conditioning about what happiness means. Okay? Well, okay, what does it mean to be happy? It means to be successful. What does successful mean? Okay, what did our parents teach us as the definition of successful? There probably is somewhat of a standard template with different variations. Yeah, but a good career, relationship, yeah, your 2.1 children, or whatever we're supposed to have now. You know, a certain kind of house, a certain kind of car, a certain kind of job, certain kind of friends, certain kind of reputation, certain kind of savings for your old age, certain kind of, you know, hobbies and things like that. And that's what we were conditioned to believe is happiness. Most of us have not questioned that. Okay, I think it's really important that we stop and think, what really is happiness? And look around at the people who we think have the things that should make them successful, or the things that should make them happy, and see if those people in fact are happy. We all have people we're jealous of, don't we? Yeah, people that we don't, that we have in our mind, gee, if I was only like them, if I only had this situation, then I'd really be happy. But if you really stop and think about those people that you're jealous of, are they happy? Do you know anybody who's everlastingly happy? You know? With their car and their garage and their family and their possessions and their reputation? Yeah? We don't, do we? So somehow this should be an indicator to us that the conditioning that we received when we were young about what happiness is and what success is just that. It's conditioning. It's not the truth. And what we need to do is look deeper inside of ourselves as, you know, what does it really mean to be happy? Because most of our definition of happiness stems on having certain external situations. But as soon as our happiness depends on external things, that is a big setup for unhappiness, isn't it? Because we can't control the world and our external environment. We keep trying to. Yeah, we try to. Yeah. We try to get everybody around us we like. we try and get rid of everybody that we don't like. We try and get all the possessions we think are going to be happy. We try and get rid of all the ones, you know, the material things that make us unhappy. Do we ever succeed in making our environment and the people in it exactly what we want? No. No, we've never succeeded. So thinking that happiness comes from certain external situations is really setting ourselves up for disappointment, because we can't make the world be what we want it to be, even though we've been trying to since we were born. What the Buddha said is check up inside and see how much your happiness comes from what's going on in your own mind. Because we've all had the experience of being in a very nice external situation and being very miserable. You ever had that? Yeah? There you are at the beach with Prince or Princess Charming and everything's perfect and you're unhappy. We've all had it, okay? So, you know, that doesn't work. How much does what's going on in our own mind play a role in how happy we are? And this is a very good thing to keep looking at and keep questioning. And we can see that the more self-centered we are, the less happy we are. So the more that we're sitting here, you know, I'm the gift to the universe and the universe should appreciate me and I'm entitled to have everything, that thought is what makes us miserable. Not getting the things we want isn't really what makes us miserable. It's the craving to have those things that's the setup for misery. Okay? The craving to have those things comes from inside. Once we have the craving, that's it, you know, because even if we get it, it's not going to be good enough and we're going to want something new after a while. So real peace in the mind comes when we can start to subdue that craving, okay? When we can start to relinquish that self-centered thought, okay? That's when real contentment comes in the mind. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama always says, if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish and take care of others. So he puts forth compassion as a way to find internal happiness. And we always call compassion for other sentient beings as a way to make myself happy. I'm going to be miserable if I'm compassionate. Yeah? Because then I'm going to be so involved in others' suffering, it's going to tear my heart out, and I'm going to be depressed, and I'm going to try and fix their problems, and they're not going to listen to me, and, you know, I'm going to be miserable if I'm compassionate. I remember this was kind of my thought the first time I heard His Holiness say that. But because His Holiness is my teacher, I thought I'd better not make too quick of a judgment. You know, I better think a little bit about what he said, because he might know what he's talking about. And I figured out in the end he did. You know, he always does. And it involves really learning what compassion means. Okay? So compassion, from a Buddhist sense, means simply wanting sentient beings, ourselves included, to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Okay? So suffering doesn't just mean the ouch kind of suffering that everybody can identify as suffering. Suffering, from a Buddhist perspective, also includes getting what you want. But because getting what we want is not going to be an everlasting situation, we're eventually going to be separated from it, and that happiness is going to decrease. But that is also a form of suffering. Okay? And actually, from a Buddhist perspective, just having a body like this that gets old and sick and dies is a form of suffering. So when we think of us sentient beings being freed of suffering and its causes, there's a very big scope to it. You know, it doesn't mean that we become Pollyanna and we're trying to fix the world's problems. Okay? Because that kind of compassion is, like I was saying before, that's the I'm going to fix your life kind of compassion, which it really isn't compassion. It's more I want to control you, and I know what you should do better than you know what you should do. Okay? And that doesn't bring any happiness. Okay? But this kind of compassion is really looking in the long term and seeing that the causes of all of our suffering comes from within. Okay? The causes of all of this suffering comes from the self-grasping ignorance. It comes from the self-centered thought. So if we want to, for sentient beings, ourselves and others, to be free of suffering and to have happiness, then the primary thing is to be free of these two. Okay? So then the question comes, well, how do we free ourselves from the self-centered thought? How do we free ourselves from the self-grasping ignorance? And so this is, you know, one of the reasons why we practice the Buddhist teachings, because the Buddha, you know, was able to give a roadmap on how to accomplish all of this, okay, by listening to the teachings, reflecting on them, meditating on them, practicing them, okay. So we switch our focus to really taking care of everybody, not just ourselves. And taking care of everybody in the long term, knowing that we're not going to be able to fix all the world's problems, you know, right now, or even next month, or next year, but really looking in the long term. And if we have this long-term perspective, it gives us a lot of courage. It can make our mind very, very strong, okay, because what brings so much discouragement usually when we're trying to be a benefit to others is we want them to change very quickly, don't we? Yeah? You know, you have a sibling who has a substance abuse problem. You know exactly what they need to do to fix up their life. And you tell them that. Do they do it? No. Okay, then we get angry, we get upset, we feel unappreciated, you know, because we're looking for some short-term solution, you know, and we're trying to force our way on another person without realizing that we need to be very, very skillful in how we help others and think in the long term and to not get discouraged when other people don't follow our sage's advice. And to even begin to think that maybe our sage's advice isn't the right thing, and that maybe what it's really about is getting to teach the other person how to find their own internal wisdom. Okay? So we begin to look at, you know, what does it mean to have compassion? What does it mean to benefit others? Yeah? And others change slowly. We know we change slowly. So we're going to hang in there and be compassionate over a long period of time and not have expectations for quick changes. Okay? And not get discouraged when we see other people sometimes doing the things the very opposite of what they need to be doing and, you know, self-sabotaging. Okay? And I think, for me, the one thing that really helps in this whole process is, you know, when we have this bodhicitta motivation, the aspiration to become fully enlightened for the benefit of sentient beings, and we know that this can take a really long time to become fully enlightened, and we know, you know, it's going to take a while because we're slow to change, so we know other beings are slow to change. But the thing that gives the confidence is that we know that we're doing something really meaningful and useful with our lives. And so however long it takes, our time is not going to be wasted. Mm-hmm. So even if it takes a few months, You know how, you remember when you come into Buddhism and you think you're going to be a Buddha by next Tuesday? Yeah, remember that? You know, and then you decided maybe that was expecting too much. It might take a few months. Yeah, and then after a few months went by, you figured out it might be a few years. And then after a few years went by, you figured, well, maybe by the time, you know, the end of this life. And then some more time went by and you figured it's going to take some more lives. And then you began to remember that at the very beginning your teacher talked about three countless great eons. You know, that had slipped your fact in your mind, you know. And you begin to say, oh yeah, three countless great eons. Okay, I'm signing up. Yeah. And that the three countless great eons start after you enter the path of accumulation, which you haven't even entered yet. Okay. So the stopwatch hasn't even started, you know. But doesn't matter. Yeah? Because it doesn't matter. Because your mind is, you know, the direction you're heading in is one of really long-lasting meaning and purpose. Okay? And so whatever you have to do, however long it takes, whatever bumps you happen to hit in the road, it doesn't matter because you're going somewhere really good. And when then your mind says, well, three countless great eons, that's, you know, that's kind of, I can't wrap my mind around it. You know, can I do something else? Yeah. You know, when our self-centered mind says, yeah, can I do something else? Then the question I always put back is, well, what else are you going to do? Yeah? What else are you going to do, children? You've been cycling in cyclic existence since beginningless time, you know, as they say, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, for everything, you know. So what else am I going to do? Do it all over again and have another round since beginningless time? You know, it's like, you know, who wants to do that again? Yeah. And if we've done everything in samsara an infinite number of times, forget it. You know, it's like watching an old movie again and again and again. So then, you know, you begin to realize, you know, there's nothing else to do but to go for enlightenment. So then you relax. Three countless great eons, even six, it's okay. You know? It doesn't matter. Because where I'm going is the only thing, only place to go, only mental state to go for. And, you know, as even I just take baby steps towards there, you know, I'm doing something meaningful with my life. And when I die, I can die without regrets, knowing that my life had some purpose and meaning and some benefit. And we can also see that the more we practice, then the more, just by being who we are, we're able to benefit others. Okay. And so then, instead of being so intent on, I'm going to benefit you, whether you want to be benefited or not, we begin to realize that just by practicing ourselves and improving the quality of our own mind, that already benefits so many living beings. And I think it's really one of the big things. Like, I mean, so many people who are in helping professions, probably many of you are in helping professions, teaching or healthcare, or, you know, social work or therapy work or, you know, any kind of things. I mean, so many helping professions. And we always think that to help sentient beings, we have to learn a lot of skills, okay? I need some techniques. Give me some techniques and some skills. You know, and so you go to university and you go to a vocational school and you get skills, okay? And that's good, and we need skills. But I think in any helping profession, and just living a regular human life, whether you're in a helping profession or not, I think the best thing we ever bring to other people is who we are. Yeah? Because if we have a lot of skills, but inside, you know, our own mind is filled with self-centeredness and clinging attachment and jealousy and spite and envy and all that stuff, we might have a lot of skills, but how are we ever going to use them to benefit others when our own mind is so berserky? Okay? Whereas if we practice the Buddhist teachings, and slowly subdue our mind, then even you just have a small skills, those skills can really be useful to others, because the way you're giving them becomes so important to the other people. And they've done so many, you know, research things about how, let's say, patients recover so quickly when the doctors actually talk to them and care about them versus when they don't. Yeah, and you find it so often in any kind of work, who you are as a person is makes such a big difference. Yeah, and because we've all met other people, and what has it been that's attracted to us to them? Has it been their skills and their degrees, or has it been who they've been as a person and their way of showing us an alternative for how to be in the world? Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? And so then the more we practice, then we can use whatever other talents and techniques and skills we have. But it all comes out in a very kind of natural way without being so forced and so contrived. And we begin to see that we can actually benefit others in a very organic way. And we begin to also see that we don't need to keep tabs of who we've benefited. Yeah. And we just are who we are and live our life in a virtuous way with a compassionate heart. And people get benefited and we don't care whether we get thanked or not. Yeah. Because the mind's really peaceful then, isn't it? Yeah. Because whenever we're helping with the expectation to get something, our mind's not peaceful. But when we're just satisfied, when we take delight in the giving and aren't so hung up on the results, okay, when we're content creating the causes for joy and aren't so focused on getting the results, then the mind becomes very peaceful with, you know, however things turn out in the moment. And we're not so hooked into what's happening in the moment in a really confused way, because we have this long-term goal. Okay, you getting what I mean? And it's funny, because in one way, having this long-term goal enables us to be in the moment in a lot better way. Whereas when we're trying to eke out every little bit of happiness we can from the moment, we actually don't experience much at all. But anyway, those are just some thoughts about emotional health and causes and how to undo, you know, some of our emotional imbalance and create some good causes. But what I'd like